This is Brian Cambria with news for the Western Slope, and it's Monday, July 29th, 2013. The Colorado Independent reports Texas U.S. Senator Ted Cruz spoke to nearly 2,000 Republicans at Colorado Christian University's fourth annual Conservative Western Summit. It was in Denver over the weekend. According to the Independent, Cruz aggressively defended his conservative vision for the nation, which includes defunding President Obama's Affordable Care Act, abolishing the IRS, and rewriting the nation's tax code. In his speech to the convention, Cruz asked the audience to support his Defund Obamacare campaign. Cruz told the Independent he believes there is a, quote, center-right consensus across the country, and that measures like abolishing the IRS aren't extreme, given what he sees as a troubling future for job growth and the U.S. economy. According to the Denver Post, Cruz won a straw poll for the 2016 presidential election at the conference. Colorado U.S. Senator Mark Udall on Sunday called for reforms to the Patriot Act. According to the Denver Post, Udall told CBS News Face the Nation that the National Security Agency's policy of collecting Americans' phone records isn't making the country safe. Udall claimed indiscriminately gathering Americans' phone records violates their right to privacy, but said the agency's PRISM program and the data it collects on foreigners' phone records is justified. Udall didn't respond directly when asked whether he believed the U.S. government is purposefully using those phone records with ill intent, stating only that the debate over the NSA program is an important one. Udall went on to say the Patriot Act is too broad and lacks what he sees as adequate safeguards. President Obama's proposed budget for firefighting next year is up 27% over this year's levels, but as KDNK's Nelson Harvey reports in this episode of Sounds of the High Country, at least one prominent wildfire expert doesn't think it's all money well spent.
When the writer John McClain learned that 19 firefighters had been killed in June fighting the Yarnell Hill Fire in central Arizona, he saw the event not only as tragic, but also as unnecessary. In Yarnell Hill, McClain saw the ghosts of tragic wildfires past. His father Norman wrote the acclaimed book Young Men in Fire about the 1949 Mann Gulch Fire that killed 13 firefighters in Montana. McClain got his own start writing about wildfire with the book Fire on the Mountain about the South Canyon Fire of 1994 near Glenwood Springs, Colorado, that killed 14 wildland firefighters. McClain says he was haunted by the similarities between the South Canyon Fire and Yarnell Hill.
Neither fire was attacked hard in its first days. They were small fires that were in the neighborhood of much larger fires that were getting all the attention and resources, and they were not thought to be troublesome.
In both cases, McClain says, firefighters were caught too far outside of their safety zones. In both cases, an extreme but predicted wind event caused the fatalities, and in both cases, far too many people died.
That's not supposed to happen. And after South Canyon, it was really not supposed to happen. I mean, we're never supposed to see that kind of thing again. There were many, many effective safety measures instituted after South Canyon that were designed to prevent a repeat.
Yet, as McClain wrote in a recent essay on the website of High Country News, the wildfire environment of the West in recent years has been changing. It's been growing more extreme and more dangerous. Average temperatures in the U.S. have been rising, so that about two out of every three summers are now hotter than the 100-year average. That means longer and more intense wildfire seasons and shorter windows for fire prevention. Budgets for firefighting are up, but budgets for prevention are down. And with more people every year living in the so-called wildland-urban interface outside of town, efforts to thin forests or conduct controlled burns are often met with intense opposition from homeowners.
The biggest factor for firefighters in recent years has been the expansion of the wildland-urban interface. But you have more intense fire conditions, but you also have more homes exposed to fire. So you'd like to, do clearing operations and one thing or another. The window for doing it is smaller. The opposition to it can be extreme, and it can also be chilling. You really want to put forward a prescribed fire, knowing that you're exposing yourself to litigation of all kinds.
There's little science on exactly how much larger, more intense, and more expensive Western wildfires are becoming. But there are some hints emerging on what it might cost taxpayers to pay for firefighting in a warming world.
There was a study done in Montana of what the effect would be economically on firefighting by a single degree increase in temperature. It was found that that would roughly double the firefighting budget. So this thing is going to have a life of its own. I mean, firefighting already takes over 50% of the United States Forest Service budget. Federal expenses for firefighting have tripled in the last 10 years to $3 billion. Let's say they double again. All of a sudden, there's no money.
There's no money, he says, for trail maintenance, campground services, and all the other things that benefit the general public who visits our national forests, rather than simply the people who live out there. If people are going to build homes in the wildland-urban interface where there's high wildfire risk, McLean believes that the person footing the bill shouldn't be the federal taxpayer who funds the Forest Service's firefighting capacity, but rather the property owner themselves.
Why should the federal government underwrite a mortgage on a property that is in a very dangerous part of the wildland-urban interface? Why not deny the mortgage or deny the federal guarantee on that mortgage? That would get people's attention. When you do fight one of these fires, and you put millions of dollars into it, why not send a bill? That would get people's attention, so that a county commissioner who is eager in his inner heart to do the right thing and deny a development has the means to say, well, look, if you put in this development, here is the cost to the county, and here is what the cost is that we're going to pass on to you, an additional cost for living out here.
Unless local leaders get stricter about prohibiting homes in areas of high fire danger, McLean says the problem is likely to get much worse. About 16% of the wildland-urban interface in the West is developed, meaning there's still 84% left to build on. For KDNK News, I'm Nelson Harvey.
The Glenwood Springs Post-Independent reports that 9 counties across the state have been chosen to participate in a new alternative fuels project. Refuel Colorado Fleets is a pilot project that encourages public and private sector fleets to expand their use of alternative fuel vehicles. The project will designate energy coaches from 4 nonprofit groups to help company and government agencies expand their use of alternative fuels. A Carbondale nonprofit called Clean Energy Economy for the Region, or CLEAR, is leading the project. The group already uses energy coaching strategies to upgrade energy efficiency in homes and businesses. The group's energy engineer, Mike Ogburn, says these strategies have seen a 70% success rate in the past. The Post-Independent reports a U.S. Department of Energy grant is funding the project and that the 9 counties were selected after a 2-month survey of cities and towns across the Western Slope and Front Range. Garfield, Mesa, La Plata are among the counties that will participate. Energy coaches will work with businesses and local government in the coming weeks to evaluate fleet needs, looking at such factors as vehicle mileage, age, type, and purpose. Garfield County Energy Coach Maisa Metcalf said the focus will be on helping fleet owners make smart buying decisions and investments. When genetically modified wheat was found growing in Oregon earlier this year, it didn't take long for accusations to start flying. No one knew how the unapproved wheat ended up in the ground. A flurry of finger-pointing cast potential blame on a federal seed vault in Colorado, which housed the same strain of wheat. The facility's been cleared of wrongdoing since then, but the investigation brings up questions of how secure these seed vaults really are. KUNC and Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon took a tour of the Colorado vault and filed this report.
I'm standing here in front of the National Center for Genetic Resources Preservation, which is just a fancy way of saying seed vault. It's a pretty nondescript building. It's beige with a red roof, 3 stories tall. But it's the nation's largest collection of seeds, genetic material for livestock and microbes. So let's go inside and see what's going on. Inside the facility, good luck getting past the lobby without a key card and passcode. Locked doors are around every corner. Luckily, I have a tour guide.
My name's Dave Dierig. I'm the research leader here at NCGRP. That's the National Center for Genetic Resources Preservation in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Dierig is in charge of the seed vault and one of the 6 people inside who has access to the main vaults where seeds and animal embryos are kept.
So, yeah, these are the doors to the vault.
We're about to head into the facility's black box storage room. Think of it like a series of safety deposit boxes in a bank. Other seed vaults throughout the world send their backup collections here. So do some private companies like DuPont and Monsanto. The room is kept at the same temperature as your home freezer. Fur-lined parkas hang on a rack just outside large gray metal doors.
Is it chilly inside?
Yeah, it is. You may want to put on a jacket, but it actually feels kind of good now that it's summertime.
To the right of the doors, a TV screen shows a live stream of the seed vault. It serves as another reminder of the building's security. In this place, you're always on camera.
Deep breath. We won't stay in here too long, but...
Inside, ceiling-high shelves hold seemingly endless rows of white pouches. In this room, there are 600,000 seed packets, which puts the total number of seeds in the billions. Some are here purely for storage, but researchers can also request seeds for studies.
And then they're all barcoded, so we know exactly where everything is.
That's another security measure. Looking at a seed pouch, there's nothing that tells you what kind of seeds you're holding, just a barcode. You need access to a secure database to find out what's inside. Downstairs, behind another series of heavy metal doors and under the watchful eye of security cameras, are long rows of stainless steel capsules. They're filled with liquid nitrogen to store seeds, livestock semen, and fish eggs.
We have anything from fish to cattle to sheep. We even do some cattle blood. But pretty much that's what we do so that we can put it in our big database and it's accessible and we know where it is.
Lab technician Angela Sosa is transferring Chinook salmon eggs from one container to another, placing them back into the liquid nitrogen. She's another of the handful of people with access to this room. The facility has been compared to Fort Knox in its level of security. But earlier this summer, that formidable reputation was thrown into question. For 7 years, this same vault kept about 1,500 pounds of Monsanto's genetically modified wheat seeds, including the same strain found growing in small patches in Oregon.
It would really be a rare case where we would keep another company's seed. There'd have to be some kind of extenuating circumstances for them to say, we need you to keep this seed.
It's a rare occasion, but as in the Monsanto case, it does happen. Research leader Dave Dierig says he can't comment on the specifics of the Oregon case, as Department of Agriculture investigators are still trying to pin down the seed source. A department spokesman says all of Monsanto's wheat seeds held at the vault were incinerated 2 years ago at the request of the company. With the investigation turning in other directions, this beige building in Colorado can return to business as usual, securely storing the world's seeds. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media reports on farm and food issues and is a collaboration of KUNC and other public media stations in the Midwest. You can find other stories or comment on this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. For KVNF News, I'm Brian Cambria. Good day.